Hello, esteemed listeners, old and new, and welcome back to another episode of the History of Scotland podcast. If you've been with us on this journey from the beginning, you know that our last episode, we dived deep into the early reign of King David I of Scotland. We explored the battles he faced against would-be usurpers, his strategies, the alliances he formed, and the influence he wielded both within Scotland and across the English border. We touched upon the various complexities of his reign that extended beyond mere domestic politics, reaching into the realms of military strategy and international relations. This is a king who operated not just on a national stage, but was a player in the larger theatre of medieval European politics. Today, however, we are shifting the lens from the public to the private, and then dramatically back to the public, but in a different way. First, we will zoom in on the family life of David I. Who stood beside the powerful man? What was the royal household like? Were his children chips off the old block? Understanding the personal life of David I adds layers of nuance to the portrait of this great king and sheds light on how personal matters influence state affairs. And also, I kind of sidetracked his son last episode. I've mentioned Maud, his wife, a few times, so I think it's about time we dedicate some time to them. But hold on to your hats, because following that, we're switching gears to discuss something monumental. Yes, it's that time, it's the Davidonian Revolution. Get ready for a deep dive into this transformative period, because understanding the Davidonian Revolution is a tumultuous understanding of framework of modern Scotland. This wasn't just a regime change or a few tweaks here and there. This was a fundamental shift that transformed the culture, law and governance of Scotland in ways that have stood the test of time. We'll discuss its roots, its effects and its legacy. Believe me, you don't want to miss this. For those who are new to our podcast, I strongly encourage you to go back and listen to our previous episodes. Our exploration of Scottish history is like a jigsaw puzzle. Each piece, or in this case, each episode, adds another layer of understanding to the overall picture. While each episode stands alone, the entire series provides a comprehensive understanding that is greater than the sum of its parts. So, without further ado, are you set? I'm buzzing with excitement to get into today's topics. So without further ado, let's immerse ourselves once again into the rich tapestry of Scottish history, focusing today on the remarkable reign of David I's personal dimensions and his enduring revolutionary impact on Scotland as a nation. Behind every great man, they say, is an equally great woman. In David's case, this woman was Maud, Countess of Huntingdon. Maud was the Countess of Huntingdon, and she was not just a political match for David, she was a person of substance in her own right. Born into the House of Wulfoth, she carried the prestige of lineage connected to the very core of Anglo-Saxon nobility, similar to David's mother, St. Margaret of Scotland. Her father, Wulfoth, was the last of the Anglo-Saxon earls, and I'm probably butchering his name as well. A man who tried to navigate the complexity politics following the Norman conquest. Her mother, Judith of Lens, was related to William the Conqueror himself, adding another layer of significance to her lineage. When she married David I in 1113 AD, Maud was already a widow, having been married to Simon de Senslis, who had died in 1111 AD. Her prior experience as a wife and a mother made her an important advisor and confidant to David I, particularly in the realms of governance and diplomacy. They had three children together, Henry, Clarisica, and Hodina. The nature of their relationship seems to go beyond the formalities of typical medieval marriage. In an era where unions were generally brokered to secure alliances or consolidate lands, David and Maud's relationship was often described as an affectionate and mutually supportive one. This would have been particularly important for David, whose reign was filled with political and military challenges, but also of his own mother and father, Malcolm and Margaret, who had a very passionate romance relationship that was affectionate. So this obviously is something David would want in his own wife as well. Now, let's talk about their residence. We've not really covered where they kind of live. I'm sure you can guess, because I've mentioned it quite a few times, but the Royal Scottish Court under David was a bit interrupt, meaning that the king and his family travelled from one royal estate to another throughout the year. While David and Maud spent considerable amount of time at Edinburgh and Stirling, they also frequented Dunfermline Abbey in Fife. This was a mutual functional location. It was a religious centre, but also a royal residence, and it was a hub for governance. The abbey had a particular love for David, as he had spent part of his youth there under Malcolm and Margaret, and it was here that both he and Maud would be buried, which tells you a lot about its importance in their lives. So what about their two daughters? Well, while they were not as well documented as their brother Henry, they are intriguing characters. Clarisica and Hordina were likely educated in the Anglo-Norman culture that their parents were so cherished in, making them well-rounded, cosmopolitan individuals. Even though I'm butchering their names, Clarisica would live a life largely away from the political spotlight, but Hordina married into the French nobility, thus serving as an emblem of the wider European connections Scotland was forming during David's reign. While Henry, their brother, had the most overt influence on the politics of Scotland and England, these daughters also represented the soft power of the Scottish crown. They embodied the cultural amalgamation that was happening, a blend of Gaelic, Anglo-Saxon and Norman influences that would shape Scotland for generations to come. It's crucial to view David I's reign through the lens of his family dynamics. His relationship with Maud wasn't just an alliance, it was a partnership that likely enriched his rule. His daughters were the cultural embodiments of the changes he sought to bring about, raised in a household where the old and the new were in constant conversation. This is more than just a domestic tale, it's a vital subplot in the grand narrative of a change in Scotland. Keep these nuances in mind as we continue to explore David's impactful reign. But let's delve deeper into the life of the main son himself, Henry, later to be known as the Earl of Northumberland. Henry was born in 1114 AD, the golden child of David and Maud. He was a direct beneficiary of the diverse cultural experiences that his parents brought together, his father's Gaelic lineage and his mother's Anglo-Norman roots. Raised in the royal courts of Scotland and England, Henry was groomed to be not just a future king, but also a diplomat and a warrior. His education was thorough, comprising of languages, statecraft and martial arts. Given the tumultuous nature of his times, Scotland was engaged in various territorial disputes and England was dealing with its own internal conflicts, Henry's training was not just ceremonial, but highly practical. Henry was strategically married to Ada de Warenne, a union that aimed to strengthen Scotland's ties with the Anglo-Norman aristocracy. Ada was the daughter of William de Warenne, 2nd Earl of Surrey, and Elizabeth de Vandemose, a family rich in both lineage and resources. Together, they had 7 children. Malcolm, who would be known as Malcolm IV later on. William, who would be known as the famous William the Lion. David, who would become Earl of Huntingdon. Matilda, or Maud, of Scotland. Marjorie of Scotland. Ada of Scotland. And then another Margaret of Scotland. Notably, Malcolm and William would eventually reign as King of Scotland, but that's obviously for us to explore in the future. Just keep note of their names for now. Their other children were equally impressive. Margaret married Conan IV, Duke of Brittany. Ada married Floris III, Count of Holland. And David became Earl of Huntingdon and married Matilda of Chester. These marriages further spread the influence of the Scottish royal family across Europe, a legacy of Henry's which cannot be overlooked. We will try to keep in touch with Henry's kids as we move throughout the rest of David's reign, but sources tend to be scarce when they leave the nest, so we'll try our best to keep you up to date where they are and what's going on with them. Henry lived at a confluence of cultures. He was the embodiment of the emerging Scoto-Norman culture, a blend, as we've said, of the Gaelic and Anglo-Norman traditions. This made him a valuable asset to his father, David, both in terms of governance and military prowess. Henry was frequently his father's right-hand man in battles and campaigns, showing an aptitude for strategy and bravery that was lauded in the chronicles of the day. Although specific details of his participation can be sketchy due to the limited records from the time, Henry's military career can be understood in the broader context of David I's military activities and the complex relations between England and Scotland. For instance, during the civil wars in England between Stephen and Matilda, known as the Anarchy, David I seized the opportunity to extend Scottish influence in northern England. Henry was involved in these campaigns, including the Battle of the Standard in 1138 AD, which we covered in the last episode. While we know the battle was a defeat for the Scots, it did lead to the Treaty of Durham, which secured Henry's inheritance of the earldoms of Northumberland, Huntingdon and Carlisle, albeit as a vassal of the King of England, which was Stephen at the time. Henry was also instrumental in maintaining Scottish rule over territories in northern England and on the Scottish borders. As Earl of Huntingdon, he had responsibilities of governing these volatile regions, working to suppress rebellions and secure Scottish holdings against English counterattacks. His rule as an earl would have been a testing ground for his military skills, as a title brought with it both lands and military obligations. In terms of internal Scottish affairs, Henry was also involved in the quelling of uprisings and consolidating the rule of the royal house. His presence would have been a stabilising factor during the revolts led by the rival claimants to the Scottish throne and discontented nobles. His father, David, had to deal with multiple insurrections, notably from the claimants like Malcolm MacAlexander. Henry's military aid in these matters was crucial for the survival of his father's reign. But Henry's untimely death in 1152 AD, likely from an illness, was a severe blow to David I. He was ill for some time, and David and Maud tried to bring him back to positive health. But alas, they failed. He had been grooming Henry as his successor, David, and his death led to a crisis of succession that would eventually see his younger brother, Malcolm IV, ascend to the throne. Henry's legacy was not just in his military support for his father, but also in his children, who would go on to rule Scotland and contribute to its history. So while we may not know the grandeur account of every battle Henry participated in, his military role under David I was substantial and multifaceted. His activities helped expand and secure the Scottish realm, both internally and externally, during one of the most particularly volatile periods in British history. But when Henry died in 1152 at the age of 38, the impact was devastating. David had lost not just his son, but also his key advisor and the future of his dynastic plans. The void left by Henry was palpable, emotionally for both David and Maud, but also politically. David had to reconsider his strategies politically, and also particularly concerning his ongoing projects to integrate Anglo-Norman law and governance into Scotland. Henry's legacy lived on in multiple ways during David's reign. The alliances he helped forged, his kids, and Henry can also be seen as a prototype of the Scoto-Norman prince, culturally diverse, politically savvy, and military capable. The family alliances he left behind would bear the fruit for generations, helping to strengthen Scotland's position in a complex and often vital European theatre. Henry was the epitome of the cultured, chivalric, and military skilled prince. His untimely death created a vacuum, but also a legacy that would shape Scotland's history for years to come. Both his sons, as we know, would continue his work and his grandfather's work, David, in each of their own way, navigating the tricky waters of Scoto-Norman politics, Scottish governance, and the international diplomacy scene in Europe. But alas, let's leave Henry dead on his deathbed, being buried at Dunfermline Abbey, both David and Maud grieving over their son's death. But David had to pick himself up. He was the King of Scotland, and he had a revolution to start, the Davidonian Revolution. Now, the Davidonian Revolution isn't just a set of administrative changes, It's a titanic shift in Scotland's social, political, economic and religious landscape. Now, we're going to deal with more of the political and economic stuff in today's episode. The religious stuff will come in the next episode. But it's a period where David I worked on overhauling the existing Gaelic traditions with the Anglo-Norman system, resulting in the amalgamation of two diverse cultures. This meant the modification or replacement of almost every institution in the land, from law courts and landholding patterns to religious establishments and even modes of dress and language. To fully comprehend the magnitude of the Davidonian Revolution, we have to place it in the broader European context. The term European Revolution here refers to the sweeping changes that occurred in mainland Europe from roughly the 10th to the 13th century. Europe was emerging from the chaos that had followed the fall of the Western Roman Empire. Kingdoms were becoming more centralized, a development accelerated by the Christian Church's unifying spiritual authority and the rising merchant class in the burgeoning cities. The Gaelic system in Scotland, with its decentralized clan-based governance, stood somewhat apart from these changes. It was a system that was about to undergo a radical change with David I's ascension to the throne, which could almost be seen as Scotland's delaying entry into this European revolution. David fundamentally changed the way Scotland was governed. Before his reign, power was diverse, spread across clan chiefs who operated more or less independently of the crown, like we have seen with Macbeth when he took on Duncan. David I introduced the concept of feudalism to Scotland. Although it was there under his father, Malcolm, in different ways, this is where it truly came in. It was a giant shift. In this new system, land was held from the king as an ultimate landlord, with nobles owing their military service in exchange for protection and lands they received. So lands like Moray that were recently taken over, that were a hotbed for activities such as where Macbeth came from, were now being held directly from the king, which made it easier to quell rebellions. It created a hierarchy that didn't exist before. It centralised the power that was previously scattered among the tribal lords. David went further by institutionalising the governance through the introduction of sheriffs, a role imported from Anglo-Norman England. These sheriffs were responsible for law enforcement, tax collection and local governance, among other duties. It's also crucial to note that David revamped the legal system, incorporating Anglo-Norman law into existing Gaelic laws, which resulted in a more standardised and centralised judicial system. He also began summoning councils of his nobles for major decisions, mimicking what would later become the English Parliament. These councils, which were in essence feudal courts, added a veneer of conservative governance to the increasingly centralised royal power in Scotland. David brought transformative changes to the Scottish court as well, fundamentally altering its structure, operation and culture. Prior to his reign, the Scottish court had been a relatively mobile and loosely organised, reflecting the decentralised nature of the Scottish kingdom. David worked to bring a level of formalisation and structure to his court that was highly influenced by the Anglo-Norman models, having spent significant time at the English court himself. Key roles and offices within the court were clearly defined, and a well-delineated hierarchy was put in place. Officials like the Justiciar, Chamberlain and Chancellor became fixtures, overseeing different aspects of governance and courtly life. Anglo-Norman culture and manners also seeped into Scottish court. David introduced the codes of chivalry, the practices of heraldry, and even the concept of courtly love. This marked a departure from the mere Gaelic traditions that had dominated Scottish royal circles, and it made the Scottish court more palpable to the European nobility. Beyond cultural and aesthetic changes, David's real masterstroke lay in his administrative overhaul. He implemented a more codified legal system, inspired by Anglo-Norman law, and strengthened the royal authority in the judicial process. systems were put in place for the maintenance of royal records, a crucial element for a functioning feudal society, which is why we're able to now do so many more episodes on David's reign, because there's so many more sources to rely on. David also took steps to distinguish the secular and ecclesiastical elements within his court, aiming for a more balanced but separate system of governance. Clergy were afforded their own judiciary and responsibilities, but they remained crucial advisors to the king. David I's court was also a stage for diplomacy. Given his family's ties with the English monarchy and his ambitions in expanding Scottish authority, the court frequently hosted foreign dignitaries and played a role in the negotiation of treaties and alliances. By revamping the court along these lines, David did not just change the look of his reign, he changed its very fabric, making it a long-lasting impact on how the monarchy interacted with the nobility, clergy, and the broader Scottish societies. David I's efforts to Anglo-Normanise the Scottish government were both deliberate and profound. The influence of Anglo-Norman culture in the administrative and law became a hallmark of David's reign. One of the most significant moves David made was to invite Anglo-Norman nobles to settle in Scotland, granting them lands and titles, some of which we already covered in the last episode. These nobles brought with them a new feudal structure that replaced the existing Gaelic systems. They also introduced the concept of primogeniture, where the eldest son inherits all or most of the estate, which was less common, as we know, in the Gaelic systems. So this allowed David to bring the changes a lot faster. He was doing it from a centralized place in his courts, and his lords can do it at a more local level, therefore changing all of Scotland, not just a centralized part of the Scottish court. David made considerable changes to the legal system, as we know, adopting the principles from the Anglo-Norman law, and his lords helped implement that in a local level as well. The military also saw a reorganisation under David. The feudal levies were more tightly controlled, and the concept of a knight in service, where vassals provided military service in exchange for land, was far more formally introduced. This move helped to professionalise the army and make it a more reliable tool for the centralised state. David also undertook a significant reorganisation of the Scottish Church, which we'll cover in the next episode, but just a quick one, he invited religious orders from England and the continent to establish new monasteries and churches in Scotland. The spread of Anglo-Norman language and culture in the Scottish court and among the nobility also helped solidify the changes. Latin and French began to replace Gaelic in official documents, and the Anglo-Norman art, architecture and music gained prominence. Finally, the economic framework of Scotland was also touched by this wave of Anglo-Normanisation. David introduced the concept of boroughs, which were essentially chartered towns with certain economic privileges drawing from the English model. This was one of his biggest legacies, and something that went on to stand the test of time. The king granted special privileges and protections to these boroughs, including the right to hold markets and the imposition of tolls on goods. This had a transformative effect on both the Scottish economy and the social structure. These boroughs were often strategically located near castles or fortifications, serving dual purposes as economic hubs and military strongholds. Each borough had its own legal judiciary, with a system of courts and set of laws designed to protect commerce and trade. Burgesses, or free citizens of the borough, were granted certain privileges, including the right to trade freely. David was instrumental in founding several key boroughs, including Edinburgh, Perth, and Aberdeen, which went on to become significant cities in Scotland. His charters laid down the rules for the governance of these towns, and in many cases, these charters served as a foundation for a governance for centuries to come. The impact of these creations of boroughs were manifold and long-lasting. During David's reign, the boroughs became centres of economic activity, attracting artisans, merchants, and traders. They facilitated the exchange of goods and services, leading to an uptick in both domestic and international trade. This helped in enriching the royal treasury through tolls and taxes, giving Data greater financial independence and the means to support its other initiatives, including the many military campaigns and church reforms he would later embark upon. The boroughs also acted as agents of social change. They were often populated by a mix of native Scots, but also immigrants, including Flemish, English, and French, which were made melting pots of cultural exchanges. These legal protections and economic opportunities in boroughs also began to erode the old tribal and clan systems, encouraging a move towards a more centralised and structured society. Furthermore, the creation of boroughs set the stage for Scotland's participation in the broader European economic systems. It facilitated the country's involvement in the Hanseatic League and other trade partnerships, positioning Scotland as a player in the European economy. In the longer term, the boroughs became focal points for growth of representative government. Burgesses from these towns would later play a role in the formation of the Scottish Parliament, and the principles of the self-governance that were established in Davies Charters can be seen as early forms of democratic governance. The Norman laws that David would import, let's say, into these lands to help rule the different swathes of boroughs and castles was mainly Anglo-Norman, and the Anglo-Norman nobility led a transformative part of the Scottish nobility and contributed to the diversification and complexity of the Scottish feudal system. Some of these lords brought with them advanced agricultural techniques, better methods of fortification, and a refined sense of feudal governance. Many of them founded or substantially improved castles like Stirling, Edinburgh, and they would later become iconic symbols of Scotland. One of the most famous families to settle in Scotland during this period was the De Bruce family, originally from Normandy. They would go on to play a significant role, as we know, in Scottish history with Robert the Bruce. The Bruces were granted lands in Annandale, and they quickly became one of the most powerful and influential families in Scotland. After our next episode, we'll be dedicating an entire episode to dive into the lives and legacies of these families, including the De Bruces, the Baliols, and others, who not only shaped the medieval landscape, but also left a legacy that resonates through Scottish history to this day. But, in summary, the Davidonian Revolution fundamentally transformed Scotland, ushering it into a new era of governance, economy and social organisation. The centralised power structure and bureaucratic framework that David introduced helped in the formation of a more cohesive and stable state, as opposed to the somewhat fragmented and clan-based system that existed prior to his reign. Revolution in governance, brought about through the Anglo-Norman influences, also elevated Scotland's standing among European nations, connecting it to broader continental trends. Creation of boroughs sparked an urban revolution. These fortified towns became the hubs of trade, crafts and industry. The boroughs not only enriched the royal coffers through taxes, but also provided Scots with new opportunities for commerce and upward mobility. The economic stimulation cannot be overstated. These became the centres of Scottish economic life for centuries to come. Moreover, the introduction of Anglo-Norman lords and the resolute feudal system provided Scotland with military, agriculture and administrative expertise. The new class of nobility did not just bring military prowess, they also brought with them agricultural advancements and a structured form of governance. They were instrumental in building key castles, fortifications and institutions, leaving a permanent mark on the landscape and political structure of the country. So in short, the Davidonian Revolution did not just change Scotland, it propelled it forward. It laid the groundwork for the modern Scottish state, providing it with the political, economic and social tools it needed to evolve and thrive. It was a comprehensive, transformative time that saw Scotland shift from a fragmented clan-based society into a mere unified feudal state with strong central authority, increased economic capability and improved social organisation. The changes David introduced during his reign had a ripple effect, influencing the course of Scottish history for centuries to come. And that wraps up today's episode. We delved into the life and times of David, focusing on his family dynamics and, of course, the momentous Davidonian Revolution. Don't know why I went into a different accent there. The complexity and the far-reaching implication of David's reign has always fascinated historians, and I hope this episode shed some light on why that is the case. In our next episode, we will discuss another groundbreaking aspect of David's rule, the Church Revolution. Like his mother, Saint Margaret, David made it his mission to reform the Church in Scotland. From introducing the new religious orders to expanding the Church's role in society, David's influence was felt far and wide. This is a chapter in Scottish history that you won't want to miss, so be sure to tune in. As always, our podcasts are released on a weekly schedule with a maximum of 3 episodes per month. This episode is the second one of the month, so keep an eye out for the 3rd and final episode in September, and then we'll move on to writing the October episodes. If you want to stay updated on these new releases and get involved with other historical enthusiasts like yourselves, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at thehistoryofse1. That is at the History of SE1, or like our Facebook page at the History of Scotland podcast. I am looking to redo the 2nd and 3rd episode of this series, so I'll let you know when that is done, and then we'll have finally redone the first 3 episodes of this series, hopefully making sure the new listeners are listening to a microphone that doesn't sound like a toaster, because I'm not going to lie, episodes 2 to 9, although great in detail, are lacking the greater script detailing I did in later episodes, but also the better microphone. Anyway, as always, your feedback matters, and it matters a great deal to me. So if you enjoy the show, please consider leaving a review on your podcast platform of choice. It helps us to grow, and it's the best way to show your support for this show. You can listen to the History of Scotland podcast on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podbean, and many other great podcasting sites. Pick your favourite and tune in whenever you like. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm Fraser, and this has been the History of Scotland podcast. Have a fantastic week ahead, and we'll meet again to uncover more fascinating stories from Scotland's rich and layered past. But until then, goodbye and stay safe. Peace.